You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
I invite you to join me as we explore new ideas. I'm David Bryan. Welcome to Curiosity Invited. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Curiosity Invited. And today we are going to be speaking about stress. And I don't mean like, oh, I'm so stressed. I'm so nervous. I'm so stressed. We're talking specifically about work stress, which is a term that maybe you've heard it. It is certainly more well known than it used to be. And a large part of the reason for that is a guest today, Dr. Peter Schnall. And Peter, welcome and thanks for coming back. Peter is a physician. He's an epidemiologist. He was trained as an internist, and he has been for the last, gosh, I don't even know how long, Peter, the director of the Center for Social Epidemiology. Anyway, thank you, Peter, for being back here and being willing to have this conversation again.
Well, David, it's a real pleasure. I've been working on this issue of stress at work for 35 years now. The Center for Social Epidemiology, which people can locate online at healthywork.org, is a creation of myself and my colleagues in which we try and bring together materials to help explain what's going on at the workplace and how that impacts on working people. So it's a pleasure to be here this morning and share this information with you and with your audience.
So stress is a, you know, it certainly has a colloquial meaning, right? People talk about, oh, I'm so stressed, or, you know, well, sleep was stressful last night. But you're specifically referring to work stress, right? So what distinguishes that? What is that?
Well, you know, when people talk about stress, they talk about usually some degree of anxiety, some experiences they're having related to things that are happening in their environment. It could be personal issues, demands being placed on them by their finances or their partners in life or their families. We're more interested in talking about the specific circumstances that occur for people when they're working, in which people oftentimes will talk about stress at work as some sort of a personal matter, something that they are experiencing individually. We're more interested as researchers and social scientists and as community members as to why people experience stress at work and what is it unique about work that contributes to people experiencing stress, both feeling it, but also having physical and biological responses to the work environment that could prove in the long run to be unhealthy.
So you're not just speaking about a feeling, you're speaking about a feeling, but it also has physical effects, or at least potentially has physical effects, because it is continuous, it is chronic, or does it have to be?
It doesn't have to be continuous, but it's different from the sense that people oftentimes report of feeling, oh, I feel pressure, or I'm fatigued, right, or have anxiety. Now, we're talking about experiences that come out of the work experience, not just on ordinary daily life things. It's oftentimes a response to the way in which work is organized. That's why
explain.
We want to talk about work stressors, things that the workplace creates in its pursuit of productivity, of creation of products, getting things done. In that process, okay, there's oftentimes high demands, not enough control over the work process. And we're going to talk about these consequences of the work environment. But when we're trying to distinguish between people's personal responses to events in their workplace and talk about the things that are constantly happening in the way in which work is designed.
In which work is designed. So, oh, that's interesting. So, in other words, it's conceivable that somebody has a work environment that is not unhealthy or stressful, and or it can be stressful. Are there particular things in the workplace that can cause this work stress?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, probably the two things that people are the most familiar with are demands, okay? Working fast, hard, long hours, but maybe more than the individual has the capacity to deal with in an effective way. So, you know, we talk about how many hours people are working. You know, and the typical work week is 40 hours, but in our society, in the United States, many people work more than 40 hours a week. So that puts a burden on the physiological system, our brains and our bodies. But then there is also how much control over these work processes you have. Do you have some say about how you do your job and what the workplace experience is like? Now, when we combine these problems, high demands, but little say, and little input about how the jobs are carried out, then we have a work demand problem where individuals can be overwhelmed because not only do they have a demands, but they don't have any say about how the jobs are being done and being managed.
So it's not necessarily the quantity. I mean, I suppose that could be right. It could be so much work that there's just no way to do it. You know, it's like trying to carry too much weight. But there's also, you can have a reasonable amount of demand, but the lack of control over how you do it is sort of an independent stressor.
Exactly, David. You have it exactly right. I mean, you have excessive demands, inadequate control, lack of control. But there may be other factors that exaggerate this combination of demands and control. You may not have sufficient support from management or from your supervisor or from your coworker. So you may feel isolated. You may feel as though this is just your problem. And then the things that go on in the workplace that are damaging, in addition to having high demands and low control, you have the problems of bullying, you have work schedules which may be erratic, you may be living and working under the fear of losing your job, you may have job insecurity as a factor, so it makes every decision and everything you do even more potentially harmful to you. Threatening. You may have schedules which change from week to week. There's many things that workers in the workplace have little control over. And the less control they have over all of these processes, the more stressful the environment is. And the more the body is physiologically aroused, David, to these things, okay? When operating under high demands and don't have much say about how the job gets done, your body responds to this in a physiological manner.
That's interesting. That adds another element. You're not simply speaking about a work stressful situation. You're talking about there are physiological effects of that over time diminish somebody's health.
Well, but over time produce changes in the way in which your body functions, okay? Let's imagine you have a job that's highly demanding. You don't feel as though you have some say about how it gets done. Your boss is bullying you because he wants you to be, you don't even mean legitimately think you're not getting enough, there's not enough productivity. Well, when those things happen, you have a stress response in the body. You get aroused. You may feel anxious. And this anxiety may carry over into home. You may have trouble sleeping as a consequence of feeling that, you know, you're not doing your job well. You may be worried about losing your job. So you have to deal with the senses of insecurity. Well, these processes produce changes in your body. They create arousal. And one of the consequences of arousal is exhaustion, demoralization, depression, problems sleeping, and then physiological responses like elevated blood pressure.
I remember years ago, meaning the center, was looking at bus drivers. And I was particularly struck by the observation that their blood pressure and heart rate went up sort of as they were walking onto the bus, right? Not, they hadn't even gotten behind the wheel yet. And it was already this state of arousal, and that they were in that state for whatever counts as a shift. I mean, that's got to have long-term physiological effects, I imagine, right?
I think that's exactly right. I think you're raising a good point about what happens to many people in different jobs, but for bus drivers are a good example. They've been studied extensively. We've done research over the past 15 years on bus drivers. And one of the things we do is we put blood pressure cuffs on workers' arms, automated devices, which will take your blood pressure every few minutes. And we follow them around in their activities. And it's true that when you get up out of bed, your blood pressure is one thing. And as you get ready to leave, your blood pressure is another. And when they get to work, and literally as they step up onto the ramp to the bus, the stairs to the bus, their blood pressures continue to go up. And when they get behind the wheel of the bus and they start driving, their blood pressures are even higher. And then, of course, things happen when you're driving, which even raises your blood pressure again.
Right.
Someone walking in front of the bus almost getting hit, jamming on the brakes, trying to protect that person as well as your passengers, and doing all those things and running behind schedule. And probably most people know there are monitors at various street corners checking the buses on time and, urging them to go faster. And unfortunately, the bus drivers can't go faster oftentimes because there's a lot of traffic. You drive in a country like, Los Angeles, or in the U.S. like Los Angeles on Bogota, Colombia, where the traffic is enormous. You may be going in a crawl, but as you're going as a crawl or driving a bus, you're falling further and further behind schedule. You're going to get hassled and maybe even harassed by your supervisors about how you're doing. Why are you not on schedule? And then, of course, the longer you're there on the bus, the more you have to relieve yourself, and there's no bathrooms, and there's no place to stop to relieve themselves. I mean, the stress is cumulative, and this produces arousal, anxiety, sleeping problems, irritability. Bus drivers are not necessarily always the nicest people when you get, and they're oftentimes threatened by their passengers. You get on and
you get robbed. Because
they're threatened.
Yeah, I'm going to be late for my job. Can't you speed up?
Bus driving is one of several occupations in which there's a lot of demands on people and little control related to the job. Driving itself is a threatening activity. You have to be on constant alert no matter what type of driving you're doing for other vehicles and what they're doing. So anybody who drives a car knows how difficult it is to pay attention. We have all these safety devices now built into cars, including signal lights when cars come in at mirrors and warn us that there's somebody passing. But there are many places in the world where those things are not all that helpful, where you have motorcyclists, motorcycle drivers, and bicycles and other things weaving in and out. And the driving experience is one of continuous activation to protect yourself and your fellow citizen from being harmed.
So can we go back to the to the piece about control for a second?
Sure.
There are some jobs, some occupations, where it's hard to imagine how the worker, how the employee can have more control, right? I mean, you do have to go according to a route if you're a bus driver. So I imagine that there are some jobs where control is kind of out of the question, and others where there, at least you could imagine there would be more flexibility. And I wonder about if a job is low control, but it is somehow embedded in the nature of the job. You can't control traffic. You can't control any of those kinds of things. Maybe you could control the schedule somewhat, or at least have some flexibility there. But in those situations, is it ever a wise conclusion to say, this person is not suited for that job? Because somehow there's no way to get control. So that stress, particular stressor, is built in. Or is that not true?
Well, thank you for adding that last clause so I don't have to directly contradict you. I think it's true that jobs can't be designed taking into account human needs, both emotional, cognitive, and biological and physical. Let's go back to those bus drivers, okay? They have very demanding jobs, and it's difficult driving in traffic. But you can see that there are solutions that have been developed. You know, there are many countries in the world now that have bus lanes. They've made their driving locations more compatible with the needs of the bus drivers. So when you do that accommodation to the needs of the transportation system, you know, it's much easier for the bus drivers. There's nobody in their lanes except other bus drivers, and the traffic moves along much more smoothly, and it's much more compatible with, you know, the demands of the job. But there are other solutions for bus drivers besides, you know, a lane. You know, you can make arrangements for rest stops and bathrooms, okay? Then those are not impossible to do. They may require resources, but towns and cities which have the resources are able to provide those kinds of things. And also how long you're driving, do you drive for 1 hour, 2 hours, or 3 hours before you get a break?
Mm-hmm.
Breaks. Are they carefully planned? So if you can interrupt the demands of the driving, you can provide a safe, you know, lane in which to drive. There are adequate brakes so that the drivers can, you know, take care of their personal needs. Mm-hmm. Then the job becomes less damaging and less threatening to the driver. And so the physiological reactions are not as extreme. So that's a partial response. There's more, but it's not impossible to create a reasonable bus driving job. If the management does two things, one, they listen to the drivers, and the drivers are going to consistently all tell them the same things because they're all having the same experiences. So it's not like it's not an individual problem. It's a work-related structural problem. It's how the job is designed, how much resources are being applied to it. So if the company is willing to listen to the workers, and that's a theme all through this conversation we're going to have, that there's a need to have a dialogue between the workers and the supervisors and the managers so that the workers basically have some input, some say. This is a control. Remember we started this conversation, demands, high demands, yes. Little control. So here's an example of it. You know, many times, bus drivers are basically presented with situations where they don't have any say, they don't have any control over the work process. And so this is overwhelming and it causes arousal. It's frightening to not be in control in a dangerous situation where a mistake that you may make that's not really of your doing is going to result in someone being hurt. And obvious consequences to the driver who may be penalized or punished or even fired for something that really may not be completely their fault. So that's a partial.
Yeah, I get it.
But yes, I think that putting the weight on the individual is very convenient for businesses and companies and employers to avoid, you know, taking responsibility that they have some role in why workers get sick, workers don't function at the level that the company may want them to. And this is a whole conversation. I'm sure you want to ask about some more aspects of this. So I'm prepared to talk about the importance of workers having some input into this whole process.
Is that, I don't know if there's a way of isolating it, but is that perhaps the most important of the factors that lead to sort of unhealthy work stress or not? I mean, is that seems like a big thing, right? This control idea. Demand is obviously true, but all jobs can have their demands, right?
Yes, but here's the critical part of the conversation that needs to go on, not between you and I, but between workers and businesses. Yeah. There needs to be an acknowledgement, okay, that the design of work, okay, in and of itself can either facilitate well-being or can be harmful. Many companies want to focus on productivity. They want their businesses to move smoothly. They want to produce products that they can sell. They want workers to be effective in doing that. And they don't understand oftentimes that if the demands are too high and the support systems, including control or positive feedback from management, are not present, that the workers will suffer and that they will be continuously aroused. This will wear them down. It will cause health care problems, which will diminish their productivity even further. If you're chronically anxious, if you're not sleeping well at night and you come to work tired, your body is responding negatively, your blood pressure is up, you're eating too much, you're not exercising. There's a whole bunch of consequences that come out of stressful work that are not acknowledged by many businesses and companies as being the consequence of what of the way work is organized. And many companies, therefore, don't take the steps necessary, which is to participate in a dialogue with their workers. And that's a critical step to producing a more healthy work environment. The workers know what's going wrong, okay? They experience it. They may not always be aware, the workers, that this is due to the job design in specific ways, but they know when they're working too hard. They know when they're not kind of support they need from management. They know when they're not being paid adequately. They have a fairly good grasp of all the things that are going on in the work environment, but they have a problem oftentimes expressing that and getting management to listen. And the sad part about all of this is not only do the workers get sick from all of these stressors that are going on in the environment, but when they get sick, they have to get care. And that costs money. When they're sick, they're not as productive. And then eventually get so sick and demoralized that they go for health care. They may need psychological care, et cetera, et cetera. This is a cost to businesses. So that you see both a decline of productivity among overly stressed workers and an increase in costs of caring for all the consequences. And the companies are unaware that they are, in fact, preventable consequences. But many companies provide environments that are, quote, quote, worker-friendly. They have ping pong tables and meals and music and things that so workers can relax. I don't want to sort Google out in any negative way, but, you know, Google does a lot to promote worker well-being. But worker well-being doesn't do anything about the actual unhealthy aspects of the work environment. Okay. It's simply
it's relief.
It's a medication, but not a preventive. It doesn't really eliminate the basic issues of what's happening.
Yeah. You know, as you were speaking, you said, sort of workers are aware, and I'm wondering if more and more is the medical profession as aware as it ought to be that some of the things that people are walking into their office for, you know, it's not, well, it is in this person's physiology, but it's not only in this person's physiology. It is caused by or related to the work environment, the work stress that somebody is under. Is that now fairly well known in the medical profession?
I'm afraid no. I believe we talked about this some few years back, David, about, you know, listening and awareness on the part of the professional people. Because as trained as a doctor, one of the things I was always struck with as an epidemiologist when I was studying why people got high blood pressure, I became very much aware that there is no training in most medical schools, and that's still true today. I researched this conversation. There is still no training about taking a work history. A few occupational health, have formalized training programs that include learning to take a work history and having a work history part of your experience. But most doctors don't ask about people's jobs in any detail. They may not even ask them whether they're working or not. Unbelievable. But usually they'll ask what your job is. And that's the end of it. And you can go do a search online and ask any of the AI programs there what is routinely done by doctors. And it turns out that a good medical history is not a requirement of the job of practicing medicine or any other discipline of health care.
You just mentioned AI. I'm wondering, you know, there's a lot of reason for us to both wring our hands about AI and celebrate about AI. It seems like potentially a wonderful tool, and one can also whip up some extraordinarily terrifying, I was about to say science fiction, but they may not be science fiction scenarios. Do you have any insights into, is AI a plus or a minus?
Well, I'm particularly interested in AI. I've been using it for the past year to help do searches for relevant references and information that connect to the things that we're concerned about, the work environment, work stressors, etc. And in that way, it's been very helpful. Interpretation of the findings, however, is still an activity that the human brain is, well-trained human brains, I mean, people who've gone to school and who've taken the time to master a series of disciplines are still playing an important role and should in understanding what's going on. There is this aspect of AI that's really potentially helpful. First of all, it doesn't forget things, okay? So when you take a work history with an AI program as an advisor, you usually collect all the information that's relevant, because every time you answer a question that has other threads that make you think of other things, the AI program will remember it. And AI programs are very good at diagnosing or reading laboratory results. And you probably have heard the story that, you know, they actually do better looking at x-rays than human do. They can absorb so much more information in the process. So there's already places where AI has a niche that's important, but I think it's a little premature to think, well, you're going to go to a doctor and you're going to get an AI machine sitting behind a desk.
Well, I was actually thinking of situations where it's back to your thing about the management listening. You know, if somebody is using an AI program to, hey, can we make this bus route more efficient, and not putting in the guardrails that talk about being the well-being of the workers, then you could end up with more stress. You could end up with a situation where, okay, if it's all about productivity, you'll get that answer, but you're ignoring these other factors.
Well, you know, the issue is the design of the software, okay? If you design the software where you make the well-being of the worker a priority, and you designate in the software program that, you know, having reasonable numbers of work hours and not excessive hours, having say, et cetera, over the job process, then the program is going to be helpful. On the other hand, if AI program, the only thing we're interested in is X number of boxes of such and such produced in insufficient numbers of hours, you're going to get a totally different read. They're programs. They're not, they don't have a moral, they do have some moral guidelines, but these have programmed into them by humans. So if you have a business that's not really concerned about what happens to the humans, you're going to get a terrible AI program.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Okay. So other than more say of the workers, you know, there's a lot of more flexibility built into the schedule and whatever counts as reasonable demands. There are a lot of, you mentioned it before, right? I mean, well-being programs are a lot of kind of, so many things about, I don't know what to call it, sort of coping strategies for workers, you know, the meditation time or, you know, meditation on your own or whatever it is, eat better. It does not seem like it's an adequate response. It seems potentially helpful for this or that individual, but it doesn't seem like it addresses the structural issues that you're talking about. Am I right about that?
Yeah, I'm completely in agreement, David, with that. I mean, there's lots of benefits from well-being programs, just as there's benefits from medications. You know, people can get stressed, you can give them tranquilizers.
Not your bus driver.
You give people medicines to lower their blood pressure, but you're still treating the outcome and not the cause. Our argument is many of the health issues of modern day society are a consequence of the way in which we've structured work, but other aspects of the environment. I mean, you can't expect that people who are deprived of adequate nutrition, don't get enough money for adequate amount of food, are going to remain healthy on a long-term basis. And similarly, I don't think you can make an argument that, you know, trying to promote well-being is going to, in the long run, deal with the consequences of working, such as Amazon, 60 to 80 hours a week, you know, carrying packages around, we can take on any occupation and find things about it in our modern society which are harmful to people. And what really needs to happen is a recognition on the part of the folks developing the jobs of the need for a conversation between themselves and the working people so that the working people can share what is harmful about the jobs because they know what's happening to them. They know when they're stressed.
And so, you know, over the years, have you found a receptivity from, you know, this information? Now you've been working at this for 30 years.
Yes.
That was a lot of years.
It's a year.
Oh, there's now knowledge about this, right? And it's provable. Yes. No, and have you found that businesses, management, whatever the people who are designing those things, is there a receptivity? We can do something about this, or is it still a reluctance on the part because the pressures of business is more productivity, right? Everybody wants to make their bottom line better.
Yes. Okay. So. Let me say this, okay? There is, because there's now a widespread body of literature that supports the notion that outcomes, that work stressors are designed into the job by human beings who, in some cases, are not aware of the consequences. Distinguish what's going on worldwide from what's going on in the United States, David. European countries have a national program for job awareness of job stressors and of trying to prevent them. So does Canada. So does Australia. And those are programs which basically incorporate workers' viewpoints into negotiations with companies. Yes, there are some cost consequences of all that, but they're offset by the lowered rate of negative health outcomes. People in healthier jobs go to the emergency room less and they get sick less. They have less chronic diseases. So all of those countries are seeing benefits. In the United States, for various reasons, and there are obstacles to creating a positive work environment. We've already talked about one. It's not just that the medical profession doesn't take a good work history. Okay. The medical profession doesn't really recognize the social basis of many illnesses that we now consider occupational. The listener will know that there are diseases of the work environment, chemicals and other things that are in the work environment that make people sick. But the idea that there are psychosocial stressors, things that result from the way in which work is organized, that cause arousal of the human body, that when present chronically leads to a whole series of negative health outcomes, including high blood pressure, difficulties with sleeping, depression. And of course, we should be mentioning burnout as an example of a widespread problem, which is clearly a work-related stressor. Okay. I mean, some 60 to 70% of health professionals report burnout. And groups like the medical profession have been very busy trying to do something about it. But the answer to your question is, in the United States, there's been very little formal effort, okay, to provide guidelines to companies for producing healthy work. OSHA, which is the major U.S. organization responsible, Occupational Safety and Health Administration, they don't have any regulations at all having to do with stressors with regard health environment. OSHA, you know, deals with, you know, physical problems, you know, chemicals and dangerous machinery. Right. That we all know, but work stressors leading to high blood pressure or anxiety and difficulty of sleeping, depression and demoralization and burnout, those things are not regulated in the United States. There is nothing we're doing to try and protect our workers from the stressors that produce all of those health outcomes.
Yeah, yeah.
There is no at the moment, and it's discouraging. Part of the reason why you're interviewing me, I think, is when I retired from the University of California at Irvine in 2017, there was already a very large body of work having to do with work stressors, my own work, but there was many other people also at this point doing work. And implementing those insights that we had gained was very difficult. There was a very difficulty, great difficulty in getting any traction on how to make jobs better. And that led me to create another program inside the Center for Social Epidemiology called the Healthy Work Campaign.
Mm-hmm.
The Healthy Work Campaign is an effort on our part to educate the public, as well as working people and businesses, that work can be harmful, that there are aspects of the work environment that cause ill health, and that they can be addressed. And we believe that people lose several years from their lives because of the exposure to chronic stressors, which are not being addressed. So
chronic stressors from work.
Yes. Right. Yes.
Yeah.
And that's something which is just, you know, it's motivating for people like myself, and there are hundreds, thousands of health workers in the United States who are concerned about this issue. But we have not yet successfully been able to get legislation passed in any systemic way. There are programs in states like California protecting various groups like nurses, but there is no general standards that say, oh, listen, you should work hours. You know, work hours are theoretically limited, okay? We're supposed to have a 40-hour work week, but that only applies to labor organizations that are recognized by legislation. Most people, white-collar workers, they work many, many more hours than 40 hours a week. I'll bet right. you worked more than 40 hours a week, and you took it for granted.
You remember those days. It was crazy.
I do. That's why I'm saying that. Yeah. So I think the problem for most of us in the United States is that we don't have a high enough awareness yet of all the consequences, and the fact that it's actually not only costing dollars, but costing life years for workers.
Right.
High blood pressure, but on average, a 6 or 7 year life shortening. Life expectancy for people with high blood pressure is much shorter than people without it. 50% of adults, okay, at age 50 have high blood pressure in the United States. 70% of 70-year-olds have high blood pressure in the United States, and that's a preventable disorder. The disorder that's related to work stressors, not entirely, because other factors are important. Obesity, people being overweight, not exercising, okay, sleeping poorly. Those are all issues as well, but work stressors are an important part of this process.
I think another piece that I would love to hear the response is, you know, we live at an unusual times at the moment, and especially in the United States, for all the reasons that we all know. And I would imagine that there's a significant chunk of this society, perhaps people listening to this, that what you're arguing for is you just want to create a whole generation, yet another generation of snowflakes, right? Right. Work is hard. people need to be able to deal with it. And if they can't deal with it, then you need to find a different sort of job that is less demanding because they are fragile, not suited for real work. I imagine that there's a bunch of people, and maybe more now than there used to be because of the climate we are in, that have that attitude. And I guess I wonder what you say, what the Center for Epidemiology says when confronted with that. And to be clear, I think wrong-headed. I mean, I'm asking the question, but not because I agree with it, but that sort of wrong-headed attitude that, you know, you're just supposed to man up. Look, you just gotta, come on, life is hard, et cetera.
You know, I mean, it probably is some truth to the idea that life is hard, but should life be so hard that it takes years away from your life, that you can expect as a consequence of your job that you're going to get sick from a half a dozen illnesses that are preventable? So it's not that we're asking people simply to work hard. We're asking them to work hard and bear the consequences of poor health, lose a lot of the quality of their life because they're tired and fatigued and they don't sleep well at night and they come home irritable, and that causes disruptions of their family. The whole quality of life is affected by these working conditions. It's not just that people, you know, they have to put in 60 hours a week and so they get somewhat tired at the end of the workday. It's far more pervasive. And the problem is, ultimately for the companies, these workers who they're asking to tough it up, their productivity is going down.
Right.
As they work harder and longer and become sicker, they become less effective. It's not like we're robots and we can do 60 hours a week every week for 60 years and then we can retire with an inadequate pension and not as insufficient monies to be take care of our families, et cetera, et cetera. That's not the choices that we're being given. And no one is saying, look, if you do this, we're going to make sure to take care of you. We see the government has eliminated health care this year, or last year, you know, for tens of millions of people without any really explanation as to why they've done that. But those are health care is keeping people healthy enough to be able to work. So if they can't stay, they can't work. And then ultimately the companies suffer. And this is the message we're trying to get out there to anybody who's concerned about, you know, successful American business and enterprise. You need healthy workers. That's why we have
healthy workers, healthy, experienced workers who are rather than somebody who comes in and has not done that job.
Not even experience is necessarily the case. That's why we've had immigrants of 3 million per year for many years. We don't have enough workers in the United States doing the job to be able to manage our businesses. And one of the consequences of all of these recent changes is there's shortages of workers developing. Okay. And so, you know, it's not that I have some basic feeling that companies shouldn't make a profit. Okay, or shouldn't be productive. We need good companies that are productive and make products that enhance our lives. That's fine. It's that some of them are ignoring the consequences to the well-being of the workers and at their own expense. This is the irony.
I was about to say, and it's that extra little cherry on top. And by the way, this is hurting your business.
Yeah, but this is a very different message to get across to companies because it requires them to behave differently. It requires them to acknowledge workers as human beings who have awareness of their own, of what's going on in the workplace. They actually have something valuable to share with the company, and the companies don't want to hear it because they don't want to take the time and the energy of negotiating with workers and then having to answer to workers if things don't go well. And so we have a very pervasive attitude in this country that's anti-union, and not just to the ones that already exist, but to the idea of preventing, you know, we see the struggles that go on in our society. We won't name companies, but, you know, trying to unionize. The companies are even willing to spend more money than they would have to pay if they accepted the union.
Right. And I mean, look, more pay would be good for many people. But
yes.
I mean, I would imagine it's having to reorganize based on input from workers would be like anything. It's like learning to play the piano or the guitar. It's awkward at first, right? It's different. You had to change something and it's slow and but to do that in a way that you know is going to result in longer tenure of your workers, less absenteeism because of illness, because of burnout. It really feels short-sighted in all sorts of different ways. So
I agree with that summary there, David. It's both an attitude and a problem of attitude, but I think it's in good part, it's a lack of knowledge.
Right.
You know, there is a way of doing things that's successful. And when you have a lot of extra workers, so that if somebody gets sick, you can replace them. I'm afraid that that's one of the major factors here. And one of the reasons why I think current policies to prevent immigration is going to have a negative feedback, a backfire effect, is that by having fewer workers, it's harder to exploit the ones you do have. So, you know, this is something that, you know, hopefully will have a positive effect on many businesses. But I was mentioning that we were running this healthy work campaign to educate the public. This talk is part of the things that we're trying to do, is evidence of the information for workers. But it's the audience is not just people who are watching our show. It's the companies, okay, who don't yet get the message. They don't understand that what they're doing is counterproductive.
Right. It's absolutely counterproductive to them. Right. Exactly.
Yes.
And to their goals, to their
damaging, of course, the workers, which is the primary concern. But it would help them. It would help the workers if they would understand the companies and the management of the companies that what's happening, in fact, is detrimental to the health and therefore the productivity. But you see, as long as there's a policy that allows for a huge excess of workers in the United States,
yes, right,
and you fire an unhealthy person, which is oftentimes the case, and replace them with somebody who's younger and healthier, there's no economic motivation to change your policy.
Well, and I think actually it's only some jobs where having more workers is beneficial in the short run, right? I mean, so many jobs require experience pays off, and bringing somebody in that does not have that experience yet, well, you know, they got to ramp up, they got to be trained, so there's ultimate loss there.
Yeah, though I must say, I think more experienced, better trained workers are less likely to be excessively abused as blue collar workers, okay? You know, when we have the example of Amazon, I'm sorry to, you know, I don't have anything personally against Amazon, but politically and economically and socially, I think what they do to their workers is very harmful. And they work them long hours in part because when they fall down on the job, there's somebody else waiting for a job. And since the jobs don't require a great deal of training, this is an effective strategy that really basically ignores the well-being of their workforce because they can replace their workforce.
Yeah, well, and increasingly they'll replace them with machines. So
that also, that's another whole problem. That's next podcast.
Next, I was about to say next time, because I'm looking at the time and Dr. Peter Schnall, my good friend, I'm really pleased to have this. I'm pleased at every opportunity we have to speak. And I really thank you for showing up and having this conversation. And I will make sure to put the Healthy Work Campaign in the, I don't know if they call them the liner notes, the show notes and on the screen. So, Peter, thanks so much.
David, it's really been a pleasure. Thank you for your questions and the opportunity to just dialogue with you about what's going on. And I'm sure that there's going to be more of these because things are happening so quickly. AI, good example, but there's many problems having to do with workers' job security we didn't get a chance to discuss today. We need to pick it up again at a future time.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.